Thank you.
Okay, I thought this image was a good point of departure for our discussion on masculinity and the arts, especially since tomorrow is George Washington's birthday. It is, of course, Emanuel Leutze's depiction of the Continental Army crossing the Delaware River against a fierce nor'easter in the pre-dawn darkness of Christmas night, 1776. In the distance, we see boats transporting with difficulty horses and artillery, while the boat in the foreground allows us to see how valiantly the soldiers wrestle against current, ice, wind, even injury. Leutze takes pains to highlight differences among the men. We have soldiers from at least three different colonies. We can tell this from their uniforms, Virginia and Maryland and Delaware. There are farmers. There are frontiersmen. And the ends, of course. There's a black man wearing a looks to me like a New England outfit. There's a Scottish immigrant. So we've got men from all over the place. Each man comes to the situation as an individual, but they are all in the same boat, and they have a common mission. And the various shades of red, white, and blue in their disparate outfits coordinate to reflect the color scheme of their flag borne above them. It is a famous painting. But it's famous because of how 19th century Americans received it. Were it made any time during the last 60 years, I doubt it would have made any impression at all. Young Americans recognize it because they've seen parodies of it, or they've seen the New Jersey Quarter. Few have ever been invited to look at the painting itself as a work of art. It appears in none of the major art histories in print today. And Leutze himself can't be found in any of the single-volume art reference works I looked at, only in the multi-volume reference works. Scholars ignore this painting, except to allude to it as the prototypical potboiler, the most banal of all 19th century history paintings, as the New York Times put it. For 20 years, at the height of modernism, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, which owns the painting, could not bear even to have it on the premises, but shipped it off to Dallas for a while and then to a state park here in Pennsylvania. It's a little different today, with a fair amount of money being spent to restore the painting by the Metropolitan, where the modernist snobs of the 1950s and 1960s have been succeeded by postmodern relativists who don't have nearly as many qualms about popular art that they consider to be hokey. It was even included in the NEH's Picturing America program, which some of you might be participating in this spring. But then, again, the NEH has had a very different vision the last 8 years, hasn't it, than it had before or than it will have now. Particularly singled out for ridicule is Washington's posture, considered by many to be artificial, self-conscious, even pompous. He never would have stood, we're told, because that would have destabilized the craft. Perhaps I should have entitled my talk, "Get Real George, Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat." I propose that our failure to correctly interpret Washington's stance is a poignant and multi-layered demonstration of something quite wrong in our culture. Look at him. What is he doing, really? Is he standing? Is he posing for the picture? Is he not studying the east bank of the river? From the highest vantage available to him? Is he not doing what he constantly and so masterfully did on all his campaigns? The old surveyor is eyeing the lay of the land so that when his men get there, he can direct them most effectively. He's doing the very thing that art critics no longer do. He's seeing. He's seeing what's there. So he can help others who will be facing what's there. Leadership requires vision. Or to put it negatively, as in Doug Phillips' motto from Proverbs 29, where there is no vision, the people perish. It's by no means an easy thing. Lieutenant James Monroe is trying to see too, but he's not nearly so adept at it, at least not with the wind trying to knock him over. Leutze composed the image so that all the obvious lines are lines of resistance. The oars, the pole, the wind-blown flag. But note how all the implied lines of vision run perpendicular to the lines of resistance. So if you follow the gaze of the leaders, or the implied line of the color scheme with the red of the general's cape, or the red of this oarman here, these lines run perpendicular to the lines of resistance. The art world no longer sees because it believes there is nothing to see. Great paintings do not speak, we're told. Rather, we make of them what we will. Can you imagine what would have happened if George Washington had made of the New Jersey countryside what he would? He didn't. He saw the truth, so he could provide for and protect his desperate men, to lead them from the darkness of their losses that year to the light, toward the light of the morning star, which you can't see in this slide, and toward the light of the dawn, and to the turning of the war that morning at Trenton. Emanuel Leutze, too, saw. And through the genius of his art, he leads us. He teaches us how to see, if we would look. To the extent that we don't, we suffer a visual impairment that constitutes not just an artistic crisis, but a crisis in those virtues that the Bible attributes particularly to mature manhood. The painting we have been viewing served as an entry to my topic, of course, because it teaches us about manly virtues. But let's not stop there. My point ultimately is not what the painting teaches, but rather that it teaches. The arts are the principal man-made tools for training our eyes and ears to discern the forms of goodness and truth. And if that's true, then that leads me to infer a couple things. First, the man who does not avail himself of these tools will be that much less sensitive to those forms, the forms of goodness and truth. and that much less effective in steering himself and others to heaven, to which they point. Second, if I may change my metaphor slightly, the one who makes the art he's a scout who, having gone ahead of the rest of us, is able to guide us, is able to guide others along the way to seeing and hearing things as they are. How much better, then, if among the scouts there are many mature Christian men who, having followed in the way and the truth and the life for many years, can lead us. Otherwise, the blind will lead the blind. And we know where that leads. That's not leadership. Will they not both fall into a pit? Can we turn the lights back up now? Thanks. All right. I'll back up a little bit. I have, therefore, two related theses this morning: that Christian men need the arts, and the arts need Christian men. God uses the arts to equip men to do their duty. And in order to thrive, the arts need the influence of godly men. If both my propositions are true, then the indifference of Christian men to art is both a contributor to and a measure of the emasculation of Christianity in our lives. I use the word emasculation rather than feminization because, as I hope we all understand, masculinity and femininity are not opposites. Their complements. Where men do not grow biblically in their masculinity, they don't become feminine. They just remain immature. And they indulge the namby-pamby, selfish, and abusive tendencies of their sinful natures. Then there's likely to be a lack of both masculinity and femininity. For God intended the sexes to complement one another. And where one is sick, the other will likely be sick too. I suppose I should define some of these terms before proceeding. What do you mean, Munson, by masculinity? Well, by biblical manhood, I mean, to use John Piper's now classic definition, a sense of benevolent responsibility to lead, provide for, and protect. To lead, provide, and protect. As with all genuine callings, this responsibility has as its end the glory of God and the church's enjoyment thereof. By art, I mean made objects intended for aesthetic contemplation. That is to say, whenever we call something art, we're saying two things. We're saying that somebody made it, and that whatever other functions it might have, its form has the potential to reward whoever will pay attention and reflect on it. That is, it can be appreciated for its beauty. And there's a loaded word. Beauty. We have to talk about beauty for a few minutes because at its heart, the current crisis in masculinity is not merely an intellectual failure or moral confusion. It is also a collapse in aesthetic judgment. Men do not lead, provide, and protect. Yes, because we're too stupid to, yes. Yes, because we don't want to. I would rather sin, but also because we can't even imagine what these things look like. We can't. Having bought into the world's aesthetic relativism, we have grown desensitized to the forms of goodness and truth. which is, after all, what beauty is. Beauty is the forms through which we perceive the attributes of God. In other words, beauty is just the common word for what theologians call revelation. When we study the heavens, for example, we perceive in their form a kind of speech that declares the glory of God. Thus, humans in every culture have this notion of the beautiful, a category which enables us to think critically about form, about preference, a category which acknowledges that some forms communicate the good and the true better than other forms do. And that is precisely why we hate it. We hate beauty because we hate God. We don't want anyone to tell us that our joys aren't solid, that our pleasures won't last, our treasures won't last. So we postmoderns suppress our knowledge of the beautiful by denying its objectivity. Beauty is just a matter of taste. If beauty is just in the eye of the beholder, then all forms are equally valid, and nothing can challenge us in our aesthetic immaturity. All forms are equally effective to do whatever we want them to do. The problem with aesthetic relativism, however, is the same as the problem with moral relativism or epistemological relativism. That is, it is at odds with reality. It's pathological. Relativists keep bruising their shins in the dark with no hope of getting better at navigating because they won't even admit that there's anything to navigate. Mind you, I'm not talking about the worldling here. I'm talking about us. Bible-believing Christians who have adopted hook, line, and sinker, the worldling's aesthetic relativism, which is, in fact, aesthetic rebellion. Compared to our forefathers in the faith, we are aesthetically immature. Consider clothing, for example. Historically, Christians have understood that clothing speaks, just as the heavens do. And that our main consideration in dressing ourselves should be the well-being of those who have to look at us. Today, however, we regularly show up in public looking like we're going gardening or something. My male students intentionally comb their hair to make it look like they haven't combed it. They don't seem to realize that their appearance sends a message. It speaks, and that message is that they hate you. They hate the world. And the last thing they want is for you to think they comb their hair to make you more comfortable. In a culture where men care so little whether their appearance is a blessing to others, it is no wonder that women often follow suit. Generally, my male students are much worse slobs than my female students, but the women aren't that far behind. In such a culture, what place is there for dresses and curtsies and whatever their modern equivalent would be? Likewise, dancing has devolved into wiggling. Courtship has devolved into dating. Correspondence has devolved into bits and pieces of email because there is no one to lead. And we can observe the same patterns in all the great social endeavors of commerce, governance, education, worship, and family life. We have come to associate authenticity with an incommunicative formlessness. Because the wimps who should be leading, providing, and protecting have debased imaginations. Now, the Spirit of God, I would suggest, can use, among other things, the fine arts to remedy this. A man who is united to Christ need no longer flee the glory of the Lord, because Christ has taken on himself the consequences of our sinful encounter with God's holiness, with God's beauty. We can face beauty without fear of damnation when we're united to Christ. As Paul puts it in 2 Corinthians 3, in Christ the veil is removed. We can stop filling our leisure with soul-numbing ugliness. If we heed a great artist, he will train our eyes to delight in the surplus of meaning to be found all around us in God's works of creation and providence. If we listen to the great musician, he will play for us an ordered pattern of tones which will fill our hearts with wonder at the goodness, wisdom, and power of a God who would make such a world and who would put us in it. The greater art is, the more it has to say about the most important things. It's that simple. The greater art is, the more it has to say about the most important things. When the Lord called Bezalel to oversee the construction of the tabernacle, he filled that man with the Spirit of God. Exodus 35, 31. He filled Bezalel with the Spirit of God. Now, that's just the Bible's way of saying that he made Bezalel articulate in the things of faith. That phrase, you look it up throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. Whenever someone's filled with the Spirit, what do? They start talking about things of faith. So the prophet is filled with the Spirit, he preaches. John the Baptist is filled with the Spirit, he preaches. Elizabeth's filled with the Spirit, and she says those wonderful things to Mary. Right. When we're filled with the Spirit, we teach and admonish one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. When Bezalel was filled with the Spirit, he created designs that spoke to the nature of the covenant, to God's saving plan. The tabernacle was beautiful because its form said so much. If art is the area of human activity primarily concerned with man-made beauty, then a man who is not interested in art is not much of a man. It's that simple. For it can mean only one of two things. Either he is not interested in his fellow man, or he is not interested in beauty. Certainly, most of the great leaders in church history were interested in art. The prophets wrote the most beautiful poetry ever. David, the man of valor, the man of war, played the lyre. He played music skillfully, day by day, the text tells us. Jesus led his disciples in song. Luther was an accomplished lute player. He had a fine tenor voice. He was an accomplished composer. Calvin. Everyone's always talking about how unartistic Calvin was. People have obviously never read Calvin. I can show you places where he talks about being moved by music. And Calvin's appreciation of poetic and musical greatness is evident in his masterful editing of the Geneva Psalter. The Puritans appreciated art. And today, in the church, there does seem to be a higher incidence of artistic interest among church leaders than among the laity. At least this is the case, I think, in my own tradition, the Reformed tradition. R.C. Sproul plays a very fine violin. John Piper writes beautiful poetry. At a conference like this, I think of Doug Wilson's appreciation of the arts. Philip Ryken, Al Mohler, these are men who have written eloquently and in a sustained way about the arts because they care about them. So then, what about the rest of us? I think most Christian men are indifferent to art because, at least in this area of their lives, they have been shaped less by Scripture than they have been shaped by the world. A world that hates masculinity in the arts almost as much as it hates masculinity in the church. Because great art proclaims God's glory so clearly, it poses a threat to the world. And the modern world tries to tame art by sentimentalizing it. For more than 150 years now, we have been told that art is about touchy-feely things. It's about emotion and self-expression. That's a lie. It is not. Great art is not about emotion. Of course we respond emotionally to it, because there we encounter things worthy of emotional response, namely the good and the true. Since the world hates these things, the good and the true, it has tried to redirect our attention away from objective goodness and truth toward emotion for its own sake, making of art a kind of drug for inducing certain prescribed states of mind. And all the healthy boys run away crying, yuck. And I don't blame them. Take a look at any elective art or music course in our country, and you will find a preponderance of girls. My children sing in the Children's Festival Chorus of Pittsburgh, which is a wonderful opportunity. They're receiving as good of instruction in singing as I think you can find. And the girls there outnumber the boys 6-1. Although my college has a balanced ratio of women to men, among music majors, there are 2 women for every man. And I checked with the registrar this week, and everybody who has declared an intention to earn our studio art minor, everyone's a woman. I don't have the statistics for the Southern Baptist University where I taught before, but I suspect they're similar, maybe worse. Clearly, our contemporary culture has managed to mark the arts as gendered. I have been in churches where the hymn singing seems to have been delegated to the women. Where in pew after pew, the fathers stand there with their lips shut. You can imagine what that does to the boys. Oh, but I can't sing, you say. Oh, yes, you can. God doesn't command impossible things. if you say you sing poorly, remember that the commandment is not given just to good singers. In any case, you can improve. Scientists tell us that only 3% of the population are truly tone deaf. The vast majority of people who say that about themselves have just never learned. They've never learned to sing. They've never learned to match pitch. Frankly, it's hard work to match pitch. It takes concentration and listening and energy and breath support and obedience to the Word of God to sing in church. But I'm just not artistic, you say. I get bored at museums. Symphonies and great books are not to my taste. Well, why aren't they? What are your reasons for not liking these things? Are they manly reasons? This morning, I am here to urge you, especially you, my Christian brothers, to give the arts another shot. For the sake of your joy and for the sake of your loved ones who need you to have a healthy imagination. Contemplate a great work of art. Listen, really listen to classical music. Read a great book. Participate in some kind of folk culture. These things aren't onerous. They will refresh your spirit. Yes, they'll challenge you too. They'll require something of you. But what else do we expect from anything that's worthwhile? Of course it will challenge us. Let's stop squandering what little leisure we have on things that leave us emptier than we were before. What, after all, do television, movies, rock music, and video games promise us? What do they have to offer? Pleasure? Is that it? Well, we know from the Bible that not all pleasures are equally pleasant, and that when compared to one another, some supposed pleasures prove not to be pleasant at all. What the amusements of popular culture really promise is oblivion. They'll assault us and sedate us. They'll make our heads spin, and they'll make us forget reality, but they'll also maim us. And in their studied avoidance of meaning, they will slander the Lord. Instead, my brothers, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, whatever is excellent, think about these things. The fine arts are not just one possible hobby among many. They are fundamental to being a well-rounded person. And the exercise they provide the male imagination in vision, in courage, in delight in God, that exercise is irreplaceable. And you're not going to find it in other places, in quite the same way. As for the next generation, the best practical advice I can give is that a boy needs to see his father and the other men in his life enjoying beautiful things. It's that simple. He needs to see his father enjoying beautiful things, including the arts. He doesn't need his father to be an expert. He just needs to observe him genuinely relishing God's glory in beautiful things. He needs his father to take him to the museum and not just his mother. They can go together. In addition, fathers need to lead their families with aesthetic wisdom. They need to provide their family with beauty. And they need to protect their family from ugliness. Everybody else, everybody who teaches boys, can help by sharing art, music, and poetry with them. You don't need a special curriculum. All you need is a good recording or a good poster. Teach the boys to attend, to see what is really there, to hear the abstract musical narrative as it unfolds. Don't allow their minds to wander. Don't allow them to accept things passively, to just let the music wash over them. They must hear what's there. Teach them that art is an adventure. Tell them it will take them places they can't even imagine now. Tell them it is like mountain climbing. You can't see the view from down here. You have to climb. And naturally, that will take exertion. You might sweat a bit. You might even get lost sometimes. But that's part of the fun. Eventually, those boys will get to the summit. And from there, they'll see things so tremendous that they'll never be quite the same again. The arts need Christian men, yes, but Christian men need the arts. They will help us do what we need to do because they'll teach us to see so we can lead and provide and protect. I wonder if you have any questions or thoughts. Yes. Well, it's going to be very hard if there are no men in their lives who sing. That'll be very hard. But I guess you do it by challenging them. Boys rise to a challenge. The sissies are the ones who don't sing. You tell them stories about the great heroes who sang. Jesus sang. Both the Gospels of Matthew and Mark tell us this. How many giants did David slay, right? But he wrote all these poems and all this wonderful music. So you do it by example. I don't know if your school has a chapel. Make sure the male teachers are singing with gusto. There'll be a lonely voice probably, but they'll be audible because unless it's a high school setting, all the voices will be high. So you do it by example. You do it by challenging them, that competitive spirit in boys, and you do it through the examples of history and stories. Yes.
When she said that, I was just thinking of one of my favorite passages in Tolkien's. I think it's in the Two Towers. The coming down Rohan's coming down. They sang as they flew.
Yeah. Right.
I love reading that to my boys.
And that's one of the failures of the movie, of course. Because you can't. The books are an epic, and if you try to show that in a movie, it would just look ridiculous. But yes, the siege of Gondor is about to be broken, and the riders of Rohan are on their way. Dawn has broken, right? The rooster has called, and they sing on their way to victory. It's
that's good stuff.
the finest part of the whole thing. Yes?
How much... My boys are often shocked to discover that the Iliad or Beowulf poetry.
Mm-hmm.
They obviously have a pretty pathetic conception of it. How much uneducating or how much removal of false conceptions of what painting is, of what poetry is necessary in order... Do you think there are two stages, just remove some of the false ideas and show them...
Yes.
So
the question is this just a matter of positive education, or do we have to first deal with the prejudices? And I think the answer is latent in your question. We must first deal with the prejudice, because our boys come to us with this saccharine notion of what art is. As I said, the world hates art, and so it turns it into something else, something that lies about reality. And boys instinctively see this, and they hate it. And so we first begin by showing them how wrong that view is. And then we can positively teach what's there. You know, that the basic problem is not that the arts aren't manly. It's that we aren't men enough to appreciate the arts, and that's something boys respond to. I want to rise to the occasion. Is there a hand over here? Andrew.
How early is it even possible to start talking about art and aesthetics in a more abstract terms, like appreciating a painting or a symphony? Like how early is that even possible, as opposed to participatory?
Well, the question is, how early can we start? And I would say in some ways you can't start too soon. I often meet parents of teenagers who are just distraught because their children are lost to the noise of this world. And there are things those parents can do, but far more easy is to start when they're young. Don't play rock music for little kids. It's just simple prudence. That's hard to do because almost all music marketed to little kids today is, in fact, rock music. Did you know that? We think there's all this aesthetic diversity out there. We've got all these different kinds of music. We've got country music, and we've got rap music, and we've got... Well, it's all rock. It just is. You go listen to country music 40 years ago and compare it with country music today, and what country music is today is rock music with a twang. And it's the same with children's CDs. So you really have to be discerning. You don't let your children waste hour after hour in front of the television. It will just turn their imagination to mush. So you begin early by protecting them. And then, as we heard last hour, you give them this feast. By enjoying beautiful things with them. And when they're real little, it's going to be very simple. Little children don't have the discernment and the attention span to appreciate, you know, the glory of the Lord everywhere. My little kids are going to be oblivious to sunrises. And at first, pictures are going to be all about the story, right? And music is going to be about dance. And that's okay. That's the place to start. So you can have your 3 and 4 year olds marching around the room, but your goal is to eventually get them to listen and to see not just the subject matter in the painting, but what the painting says about the subject matter through its design, and that comes slowly, but surely by the time you reach the logic stage, they should be doing that. They should be able to interpret on their own. No, you can't start too soon, and a lot of it has to do with simply protecting them from ugliness. Yes.
This is something that my family has enjoyed here in Pittsburgh. there has pages for the kids that send them to different paintings and have them look for things that they're painting. And that's a great way to start. Example, giving them messages, learning about the things they're doing that can help them to start to look.
Yeah. Slow them down. You know, when you go to the museum, our tendency is to try to get our money's worth and to flit from image to image, and that's going to teach your kids all the wrong things. If you bring a class on a field trip, give them an assignment. Slow them, make them sit in front of a painting and see what's there, even if it takes 20, 30 minutes. It would be far better for them to take in three paintings and then they're so tired it's time to go home than to see nothing. As you flit around, and the same with music, you know, here in Western Pennsylvania, we're in just about the best place in the world for great music, between the Pittsburgh Symphony and the Cleveland Symphony, and you know, you could take a class to a concert, but prepare them ahead of time, teach them the music. An hour and a half is a long time for a little kid to sit and concentrate. But if they know the music ahead of time, familiarity has a lot to do with being able to appreciate beauty. Yes, Val?
And in Pittsburgh, the symphony has free concerts for any school-aged child. Even we just took our Daniel, who's four, to Tiny Tots and Peter and the Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
We were playing it the day before, and it becomes his music then. He's hearing his music if he heard it in his
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I've often found with boys that if you can find art around something that they enjoy, like war or mm-hmm. something like that, you often get them interested in that. And then as you work through, you know, what is this painting saying about a particular battle? But then you start introducing other things.
That's right.
And slide in other art, and pretty soon they don't realize all of a sudden they're looking at a woman in a field instead of a bunch of men killing each other. And all of a sudden they're starting to appreciate that. So, you know, introduce it through something that they get mm-hmm. and then broaden that horizon.
It's one of the seven laws of learning, right? That you start with what they already know. The Butler Museum in Youngstown is free. You know, the Museum of American Art. And they have a whole room devoted to sports arts. A whole room. Imagine what your boys would do there. Yes?
What's your opinion of the modern Christian music like Casting Crowns, mm-hmm. Third Day, bands like that?
Mm-hmm.
Are they worthwhile for the young?
Well, the problem with popular culture is not that it's necessarily all bad. It's that it says so little. And we're attracted to it because it says so little. It places so few demands on our attention, on our imagination, on our hearts. And so the problem with Christian contemporary music is its form. Its form is just not very eloquent. There's only so much you can say in a 4-minute song with a dance beat, with a rock idiom. It's the basic aesthetic effects of rock music are its volume level, and its compulsive dance rhythms, and its cool sound, and that's just you just can't do much with that, and where it is innovative, where it's better, like various kinds of alternative rock, the improvement is just in a kind of superficial difference. Well, that sounds different. It's more original. But it's not saying more. So the problem is with the form. We all grow up with rock music, and then some people have this awakening, and they want more. But in as much as they stick with this language that they grew up with, there's a limit to how far they can go because the language itself is not capable of a sustained thought that develops with a goal the way symphonic music does. It's just like with other languages. We can say more with English than we could with some monosyllabic tribal language somewhere, because we have not only a richer vocabulary, but a syntax capable of abstract thought. And the forms of popular culture can't say much. Controversial things to say, but yes.
Paul, I appreciate your insight on the male reaction to popular culture, or not necessarily popular culture, but the arts, mm-hmm. in our popular context. It's kind of a yuck.
Yuck.
And that is obviously a turnoff. Mm-hmm. It keeps a lot of people out of the arts. I mean, and I think so. You addressed that a little bit, perhaps. But can you speak more to how you can, I guess one of the things, looking at my own experience, is one of the reasons why as a kid I liked country over rock, is because the country musicians actually look like men. I mean, we can debate the wholesomeness.
Or at least they used to.
You can debate the wholesomeness of Merle, but you look like a guy.
That's right.
And I was wondering, about that sort of thing in terms of there is a feminization of the men who do art.
Oh, absolutely.
We look at some of these guys, we hear them, their response to the world is fairly non-masculine.
Yep.
To say the least.
Absolutely.
And so do you have examples in your mind of folk who or how do you address that concern?
Oh.
Do you look at the artist and say, hey, here's Luther, he'd like to drink a beer, and by the way, he's a wonderful tenor.
Yep.
How do you look at that?
Yep. Well, the main thing is simply to get your boys to actually see what's there. Because what they're responding to is not the arts. They're responding to the way the world has taught them to think about art. And all they have to do is take 10 minutes and see what's really there, and they're going to encounter something tough that's going to demand repentance, namely the glory of the Lord. So that's the main thing, is if you can get your boys to set aside their preconceptions of what art is and to truly encounter what's there, it'll take care of itself. But yes, examples help. Because really this is a very modern phenomenon, these effeminate artists that we have in our culture. Michelangelo was not effeminate. The great artists were they were brave and they worked hard and they led. Bach and Beethoven. This is a very recent thing. And it has nothing to do with the art. It has to do with the world's hatred of the art. So yeah, you tell stories. You have them read their Bible. The Bible is the most beautiful literature ever. No one's manlier than Jeremiah, but those first 7 chapters are so beautiful that they'll break your heart. And you're encountering there difficult stuff. Yes?
Just thinking of your college statistics,
mm-hmm.
As far as encouraging boys to go into the arts for a living or whatever. You know what I'm saying? There's that block. Well, for the girls, it's okay. It's great. It's mm-hmm. a great thing to do. A great mm-hmm. family. And but for the boys, how realistic. You know what I'm saying?
In terms of a career, how wise is it to encourage a breadwinner to pursue a career in the arts, is what you're asking. Well, all leadership positions are scarce. They're hard to get. But oh my, do we need more leaders. You know, the biggest problems among the biggest problems we face is a lack of great pastors, for example. So it is hard to get elected to be a statesman. It is hard to become a tenured research scientist. But we need mature men who fear God in these positions, and so they need to try it. And it's in God's hands whether they, you know, actually get the position or not. But any young man with that much grit and tenacity to go for something that difficult will do just fine if he doesn't get that rare position. It's the shiftless, visionless young people that are going to be troubled. Yes. No, it's. I see that every day in my work. Young people who would be better off doing something else. They would make a great plumber. I can't get a plumber to come to my house. There just aren't any, right? Actually, I do have a good plumber, but it was a bad example. But you know what I'm talking about. So your point is well taken, that we need, the body of Christ is diverse. And just as the body has eyes and feet and hands and we need them all, we need in our kingdom work all sorts of gifts doing all sorts of things. But right now, there aren't too many God-fearing men in the arts, and that's a big problem.
Mm-hmm. You know, the person may not make the $100,000 a year or even 50, mm-hmm. but why can't they live on $30,000 or $40,000 a year? Why do we have to push on them to have a certain type of house or a new car every 3 years or 2 years and that type of thing?
Well, that's right. He doesn't need to be the chairman of the National Endowment of the Arts. He can lead the church aesthetically in any number of positions where, you know, as long as he can provide for his family. Yes?
I think that also just ties into looking for how God has gifted our children. I would think that as a parent, if your child is a person, you know, late high school, college, and is showing true giftedness in the arts because you encourage that throughout their life, that you would encourage them that way.
Right.
But, you know, just looking at how God has gifted our children.
Mm-hmm. That's vocationally, that's true. Avocationally, I think that there's a place for the arts in for everybody, and a boy who doesn't care about the arts is going to be handicapped, in much the same way that a boy who doesn't care about physical fitness. The team spirit that comes with playing sports is also handicapped. But I see our time is up. Is there a short question? No? All right, thank you very much.